Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ricci, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office, self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ricci, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Like those that came before, another attempt to change Florida's gun policies is shot down before it even reaches the debate stage.
We worry about victims' rights in Marcy's Law. We worry about the Greyhounds. But because of this adherence to this rule, we do not worry about reducing the number of people murdered in the state of Florida.
Also this week, the state's Constitution Revision Commission gives a bit more consideration when it comes to the matter of education.
So what we want to see is not necessarily an expansion of the charter school sector, but an increase in quality in the charter school sector.
We'll also find out what U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions had to say about the opioid crisis when he visited Tallahassee this week and discovered that a longstanding logjam on Florida's medical marijuana front may be on the verge of breaking. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. This edition of Capitol Report happens on the eve of a series of marches and rallies across the country called March for Our Lives. The main event is happening in Washington, D.C. In Florida, satellite events will occur in many locations, such as Miami, Orlando, Key West, and Tallahassee. But not all of the activism about state and national gun policy has been taking place on the street. Once again, the latest effort to reform Florida's gun laws failed. It was in response to last month's deadly mass school shooting in South Florida. As Sasha Cordner reports, as some clamored for an assault weapons ban and more background checks, Florida's Constitution Revision Commission refused to take up any measures that would do that.
Hello, I'm David Hogg, and I am one of the individuals that was at school at Marjory Stoneman Douglas on February 14th. And amazingly enough, I survived.
David Hogg is one of the faces of the Never Again movement started by Parkland teenagers protesting gun violence. He and other Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School students survived the mass shooting that left 17 people dead and 17 others injured.
17 of my fellow friends and amazing individuals that wanted to change the world and were going to no longer can, and that's why I'm here to speak on their behalf.
Hogg and others, as part of the Never Again movement, have been trying different avenues to get some of their gun control efforts accomplished, whether it's talking to the Florida legislature, holding rallies, speaking to members of Congress, and taking part in Saturday's March for Our Lives rally. Another hope of theirs was to get something done through the Florida Constitution Revision Commission. The CRC is a 37-member panel tasked with revising the Constitution every 20 years and will put matters before voters on the November ballot. During a recent CRC public hearing tour, Hogg and others with the Never Again movement pleaded with commissioners to do something. Dylan Bearline, who graduated from Marjory Stoneman Douglas last year, asked the commissioners to file a proposal to override a current state law that prohibits local governments from creating their own gun control policies or face a fine.
This statute allowed the current mayor of Tallahassee, Andrew Gillum, to be sued by Florida Carry and the Second Amendment Foundation, two gun rights organizations, for attempting to ban the use of firearms in public parks. It allows corporations to sue local legislators for any move they make that may inhibit or negatively affect in any way gun sales. This is why local leaders are afraid to do anything about gun regulation in our state.
Others also called for an assault weapons ban and universal background checks, and gun owners like Parkland parent Kevin Quinn felt the same way.
I've been a gun owner since I've been 12 years old. I'm legitimately part of the gun culture, but it was a tool. Something's happened somewhere along the way, and the message has gotten terribly toxic, and it's getting hijacked. 18 to 21, universal background checks, assault rifles, limitations based on magazine size. These are common sense reforms that do not infringe upon me or other responsible gun owners.
Several CRC commissioners like Roberto Martinez tried to attach some gun control amendments to a proposal. Martinez said a recent Quinnipiac poll supports those efforts.
On the question of whether or not you support requiring background checks for all gun buyers, the poll indicated that 96% of the voters supported it, 94% of Republicans, 97% of Democrats. And by the way, for the record, in case you didn't know, I've been a Republican for 31 years.
One amendment by Martinez mirrored the new gun safety law recently approved by Governor Rick Scott. It includes the ban on bump stocks and raising the minimum age for anyone to buy a gun to 21, already subject to a couple lawsuits. Martinez insisted all he wanted to do is let the voters decide.
This is a once-in-a-lifetime-for-all-of-us issue. This is a once-in-20-years issue, because we won't be meeting again until 20 years from now. Please do not give up this opportunity.
But that, as well as other proposals, were not allowed to be taken up because opponents said it had nothing to do with the initial CRC proposal, repealing what's known as the Alien Land Law. Originally aimed at Asian immigrants, the current law prohibits them from owning land or property. Former Senate President Don Gates was one of the CRC commissioners who did not want to take up the gun control amendments.
So I don't believe that this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. There was an opportunity. The legislature took it. Maybe each of us could have written a better law than the legislature passed. I don't know. But they passed it, and what Commissioner Martinez has done is to simply parrot what the legislature has already done. And I don't think the reason to place it in the Constitution deals with the challenge that will really occur, which will be in federal court.
Other proposals that failed to be taken up by the CRC included an assault weapons ban and comprehensive background checks for purchasing a firearm. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Possible changes to Florida gun law wasn't the only thing the Florida Constitution Revision Commission was wrestling with this week. The commission began the week with about three dozen possible add-ons to the state's foundational document. By week's end, that number had been narrowed down to around two dozen. Four key Constitution Revision Commission proposals that would impact K through 12 education are now a step closer to being in front of voters in November, and we get that story from Ryan Daly.
A Constitution Revision Commission proposal would designate high-performing school districts as innovation districts, giving them flexibility similar to that of a charter school in how they use their resources. Commissioner Roberto Martinez's measure requires districts to have a grade of B or higher for the past 3 years and have their finances meet state requirements.
When I was on the Board of Education, many times superintendents would come before us and they would say, if we only had the flexibility that charter schools have, you know, we could do a lot of stuff at the local level, we could innovate, et cetera, save money, be more responsive to the needs of the children and the family.
Each individual school board must vote to become an innovation district. Once designated, districts must continue to meet performance benchmarks or lose the classification. Martinez thinks his proposal might be a shoehorn for passing Republican Commissioner Erica Donalds' measure relating to the creation of charter schools.
Commissioner Donalds, I think if this proposal makes it as an amendment to the ballot, I think actually it enhances the chances of your proposal, number 71, to get 60% of the votes.
Donald's proposal would allow the legislature to create alternative processes for opening and overseeing new charter schools. Right now in Florida, the only entities that can do so are district school boards.
A best practice in charter school establishment across the country has been shown to be having multiple choices for those new schools coming in to say who they're going to partner with long term to oversee them. And we want those oversight boards to be accountable to the taxpayers.
Florida has had more first-year charter schools closed than any state in the nation. Donald says that statistic says everything about why her measure is needed.
And what that tells us is that they shouldn't have been authorized in the first place. So what we want to see is not necessarily an expansion of the charter school sector, but an increase in quality in the charter school sector by better authorizing and better ongoing oversight.
Donald's also backed a proposal to put a cap on the length of school board members' service at 8 years or 2 4-year terms.
Term limits provide fresh faces and new ideas to elected office. They reduce the special interest influence and make room for the citizen legislator, as was the intent of our founding fathers.
Donald serves on the school board of Collier County. Should it get a majority vote on the ballot, her measure would apply only to board member terms that start after it goes into effect. Commissioner Don Gates's proposal to add language that promotes civic literacy in public schools into the state constitution also has moved to the CRC's Style and Drafting Committee. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
It was steady as she goes for Florida's unemployment rate during the month of February. Numbers posted today by the State Department of Economic Opportunity showed the Florida jobless number holding at 3.9%. That figure has been the same since December and is under the national unemployment rate of 4.1%. An estimated 398,000 Floridians were out of work in February. That's out of a total workforce of just under 10.2 million. Another important number has to do with job creation. In that regard, national data shows Florida remains among the top states in job growth, adding nearly 168,000 total jobs since February of last year. That figure is behind only California and Texas. Still to come on Capitol Report, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions says the Trump administration is taking the opioid crisis seriously.
President Trump has said career drug traffickers can take more lives than even a mass murderer.
A very old battle among Florida hospitals as to which one should be allowed to open new trauma centers may now be history.
We have done, I think, a very good job between safety nets, HCA, other for-profits, as well as the Senate to be able to get to what most would consider a significant compromise.
Amidst growing frustration from Florida's legislature, the Department of Health has begun making progress on the state's medical marijuana industry.
The current state of medical marijuana in Florida is very much in flux and kind of a study in contrast.
And a coalition of mental health service providers has begun mapping a strategy for bringing those services into the public schools.
To have immediately available mental health resources dedicated to the mental health and the mental wellness of our kids right there in the schools.
U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions says opioid abuse is a serious issue across the state of Florida and the country as a whole. 2016 data shows more than 100 people died every day from drug abuse, and Sessions says when the 2017 data is released, he expects to see that number climb. But Regan McCarthy reports the Attorney General outlined plans he says could help curb that trend in 2018.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions says President Donald Trump included some bold goals when he unveiled a new three-pillar plan to tackle the opioid epidemic.
He set a goal for us. We're going to reduce the prescription opioids by 30% over the next 3 years. I think that's doable. It's something I have known we need to do. The plain fact is we are prescribing too many opioids in America today. I think most people know that, and we've got to be careful about it. It's causing addiction, and people who get addicted don't just walk in to a treatment center one day and come out the next and not be permanently impacted.
Another goal Trump announced relates to stopping drug dealers. In some cases, Sessions says those dealers can be licensed physicians, committing what he calls health care fraud. He says a dozen prosecutors have been dispatched to opioid hotspots throughout the country, including Central Florida.
These talented and experienced prosecutors will work with the DEA, FBI, the Department of Health and Human Services, as well as our local partners in state and local law enforcement to target and prosecute, unfortunately, doctors that need to be prosecuted, pharmacies, medical providers who are exploiting the drug epidemic and lining their pockets, many of them making astounding sums of money for just simply writing prescriptions.
The president has suggested part of the crackdown should also include capital punishment. And Sessions says he's told prosecutors not to hesitate to apply the death penalty when appropriate. Sessions says drug dealing often leads to violence and murder.
President Trump has said career drug traffickers can take more lives than even a mass murderer. Overdose deaths are up and gang violence is up, and we need to reverse those trends.
And Sessions points out capital punishment is already an option in Florida. A law passed in 2017 amended the state's murder statute. Under the new rule, if a person is found to have died from a synthetic opioid, the dealer can be punished under capital murder. Governor Rick Scott says he's proud of the work done by state lawmakers during the past two legislative sessions.
We passed a good bill that I'm proud to sign. It's hopefully going to stop as many people from being addicted on top of providing services to those that do. Last year, we passed legislation that increased the penalties for those that are trafficking in these drugs.
Legislation passed by Florida lawmakers this year limits prescriptions to a 7-day supply in most cases and increases the use of a prescription drug monitoring database. The third piece of Trump's plan relates to treatment and education. The Trump administration created a website called The Crisis Next Door. It encourages people to tell their stories about how opioid abuse has impacted their lives or their families in an effort to reduce the stigma associated with addiction. President Trump recorded his own video.
Every day, about 175 Americans die of drug overdose, and the majority of these deaths are caused by opioids. That is why my administration has declared the opioid crisis a national public health emergency. The opioid epidemic is truly the crisis next door. But too often, we forget that. Stigma, silence, and a lack of information prevent us from confronting this crisis as we should. We launched this website to bring together the stories behind the opioid epidemic.
Trump says overcoming the opioid crisis will require a group effort involving families, communities, law enforcement, and local, state, and federal leaders. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Governor Rick Scott and state lawmakers hope a new law will end fights between hospitals over establishing new trauma centers. Lynn Hatter reports the law is a compromise between key players in Florida's hospital industry.
The compromise involves how many trauma centers can be in one area. Right now, there can be no more than 44 of them in the entire state, and licenses are granted according to region. Those regions or trauma service areas are determined by population, and the state has 19 of them. But in recent years, healthcare providers have clashed over the current rules, the designation of what is and isn't a trauma center, and over whether other trauma centers should even be allowed to open.
We have done, I think, a very good job between Safety Nets, HCA, other for-profits, as well as the Senate to be able to get to what most would consider a significant compromise.
That's Republican Representative Jay Trumbull laying out some key points of the new law.
The department will prepare an analysis of statewide trauma system every 3 years, beginning August 2020. The application approval process is revised so the department may only accept a letter of intent to open a new trauma center if there is statutory need for an additional trauma center.
The new law changes the regions from 19 to 18 and lowers the statewide cap on trauma centers to 35. It keeps the population rules in place. For example, there can be no more than 2 trauma centers in an area with 1.25 million people. In areas with 2.5 million people, there can be 4 trauma centers. The Department of Health would be able to determine if more are needed. Steve Asensio works with the hospital chain Columbia HCA.
It's a delicate balance to present a product to you that I think the entire state can be proud of.
The fights have often pitted safety net hospitals, which serve large numbers of uninsured and underinsured patients, against private ones like Columbia HCA. Safety nets have argued new facilities take away patients and doctors, but HCA has argued adding new centers provides greater access. The new law will allow existing centers to be grandfathered in, and that's good news, says Mark Delegal of the Florida Safety Net Hospital Alliance.
We have worked hard with the stakeholders, with Representative Trumbull. We appreciate the work and resolve this decades-long battle over trauma. I think we've reached a good place. I don't think everyone got everything that they thought was necessary, but at the same time, I think we're going to be proud of this work product in the future.
A staff analysis of the law notes the legislation should resolve most of the existing lawsuits surrounding trauma centers. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
The Florida legislature has grown tired of the Department of Health's lack of progress on medical marijuana rules. The frustration has led DOH to conduct a series of workshops to move forward on the issue. The most recent one focused on pesticide use. We get that story from Andrew Quintana.
Ben Polera is the executive director of Florida for Care, a medical marijuana advocacy group. He has become frustrated with the handling of Florida's medical marijuana industry.
Part of the department's history of incompetent management and dereliction of their responsibilities. I mean, this is not new. For the past 3 years since Christian Bax has headed up this department, they've got a history of failing to meet deadlines and wherever they can figure out a place to screw up, they've managed to do so.
Despite 71% of voters voting in favor of medical marijuana in the 2016 election and 85,000 Floridians registered to receive a medical license, the Department of Health has not been able to keep up with the demand, failing to implement many rules and regulations for a cannabis industry.
A lot of the implementation of the law still simply has not happened and has been going extraordinarily slowly. The Department of Health has failed to get people their ID cards in a timely manner. There was a story just in the last couple weeks that said there was almost 30,000 people waiting to get their identification cards because of technical issues with the office.
This lack of progress has forced Florida's legislature to threaten the DOH's higher-ups with a $1.9 million cut if they do not follow through with their legal obligations by July. In response to this, the DOH has scheduled several workshops over the last few weeks. On Friday, the issue of pesticides was covered. A proposed rule by the DOH allows pesticides that are classified as minimum risk to be used for growing and harvesting the plant. But for Jody James of Florida Cannabis Action Network, that is not enough.
Right now, there is no pesticide that has been approved for a product that is going to be concentrated. We do not have test results, so that we can know that a pesticide that is being processed not through through the lungs but not through the liver are going to be safe.
James understands the DOH has their hands tied when it comes to the use of pesticides, as it is legally required, but asks for transparency in the use of chemicals.
I don't want to see long labels, but I want to see great inserts. I want everything that goes on to every plant to be laid out for a consumer that is particularly sensitive, like the patients I represent. And at the end of the day, I want to make sure that people aren't doing R&D on my patients.
The next medical marijuana meeting the Department of Health will conduct is scheduled for next month. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Andrew Quintana.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, a few weeks ago, Florida Governor Rick Scott signed the state's school safety bill into law. Part of the new law sets aside $69 million to provide mental health resources in schools. But those resources are already being marshaled for the schools in Leon and several surrounding counties near the Florida Capitol. Jay Reeve is the CEO for the Appalachie Center, a community-based mental health services provider in Florida's Big Bend area, but his organization is also part of a 20-agency mental health consortium in the region. He says he and two of those partners, Mike Watkins from Big Bend Community-Based Care and DISC Village's John Wilson, decided not to wait for direction from the state on how to turn the new law into reality.
We've been talking to the school superintendents across the region about what we can do to maximize those resources so that rather than trying to reinvent the wheel or create another system within the schools, we could use the system that we currently have in existence at Appalachie Center and at DISC Village to be able to provide those services within the schools.
Reeve says that would greatly expand the capabilities of the existing counselors within the schools who have found themselves doing more academic paperwork than counseling in recent years.
It hasn't left much room for the direction that the legislature wants to go, and frankly, I think the direction the state needs to go, which is to have immediately available mental health resources dedicated to the mental health and the mental wellness of our kids right there in the schools.
Sort of like having mental health school resource officers, says Reeve.
So what we would love to see would be contracts with the schools across the region where we're able to put several therapists or counselors with case managers, certainly in each school district and ideally in as many individual schools as we can, who would work as part of the team within the school.
All resources that the Appalachie Center and other partners are already set up to provide.
It's a way of working within a system that already has child psychiatry, already has case managers, already has therapists. And there's also some ways to braid some of the funding that we can actually end up with significantly more bang for our buck.
And even expanding what's available to the schools through provisions of the new law.
It calls for the development of mobile crisis teams, which my friends in law enforcement were thrilled to hear about because we've been trying to figure out ways to fund something like that in this region for years, and now it looks like the funding is going to come down.
Reeve and his partners don't have a final price tag for all this, but he's confident the plan in full or in part is totally doable. And once the plan is in place and signed off on by the region's school superintendents, he insists it can happen fast.
That's one of the things that is helpful about partnership between community mental health and the schools. We're very used to setting up systems and setting up treatment delivery systems. We know how the hiring works. We have the credentialing processes in place. We've got all the structure and supervision. So if we've got the resources, then we advertise, we find the people, and we put it online.
All aimed at reducing the chances, Reeve says, of hearing things like, "We suspected little Johnny was going through some tough times, but we didn't know who to turn to. We never dreamed he'd do something like this." Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. We also thank Andrew Quintana. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. And from Rambana and Ricci, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ricci, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.